My lawyer, who had a great sense of humor, said that he would write him a letter stating that under the law they had no right to throw out his client's merchandise without his approval, i.e. my clock. Later, the clock came back with an explanation that there was no warranty on it, that they knew the material was not as strong as they would like, but that the customers wanted shiny material, and shiny material is weak. Obviously, they meant they did not want to mold it in high-impact styrene. Coincidentally, that day I received Modern Plastic magazine, and as I usually do, I thumbed through the pages first. And there I saw a beautiful, full-page, shiny, glossy white safety helmet made out of GE's Lexan. I tore the page out of the magazine and composed one of the funniest letters of my life describing what disaster might come if anybody used this helmet, which was made of this weak, shiny white plastic that they used on the clock, which broke when it fell 2.5 feet on a soft plush carpet. About a month later, I received a brand new top-of-the-line GE clock with no indication of how, what, why it was sent. About a day later, I get a call from a young lady from GE that I was so busy complaining, perhaps I should find time to thank him for the clock. It turned out that Hank Singer saw this correspondence accidentally, and knowing who I was, thought it so hilarious that he put the correspondence and the whole incident in the internal GE newsletter, and he was the one who sent me the clock. The relationship with Hank Singer turned out to be a very productive one for both of us, and I learned a lot about molding polycarbonate. One of our customers, Ampro, was the supplier of swimming pool parts, pumps, valves, etc. And they had a problem of the aluminum die-cast corroding and clogging everything up. And we were able to persuade them to try polycarbonate, which would not do that, and which was strong enough to withstand the abuse found in swimming pools. We did that experimental work for them, had made a handmade sample of a polycarbonate pump, and ended up doing a large amount of molding for them. We were molding a four-way valve, and it was essential that the valve be molded, all the parts of the valve be molded on the same mold, because which would require a three-plate mold with back gating. I did not know if it could be done with polycarbonate, because we were molding polycarbonates with fairly large gates. So I called up the technical powers that be at GE, and their answer was, I know more about it than they do. Try it, which I did, and of course it worked. I received the same sort of an answer when we had to mold a 10-inch comb in clear polycarbonate, which is a very difficult trick to do. The net result was that they would tell people to ask me if they had a problem until they got more familiar with the molding of the polycarbonate. And that really started me on the consulting business, which turned out to be a very great thing for me. Items 15 and 16. In the late 1940s, one of our lamp part customers, plastic lamp parts to replace brass parts using a process which he read about called vacuum metallizing. We contacted Vacuum Metallizing Corp., the only one that we knew who was doing this plating in Greenpoint, Long Island, saw the process and realized it had great potential for us in the lamp part industry. We built a prototype mold of for two different popular parts, had them metallized, and learned that while the process looked beautiful, it was not good for lamp parts because when somebody went to clean them, the adhesion of the lacquer was not adequate. Being a chemist and working with some very technically able people at VMC, we ultimately solved the problem and developed an industrial coating which would stand the wear and tear of lamp parts. We then proceeded to invest in a significant number of molds, vacuum metallized them, tried to sell them, and had the answer, brass was good enough for my father, for my grandfather, my great-grandfather, it's good enough for me. The fact that they were much, much cheaper, that they didn't tarnish, etc., were lighter in weight, made no difference. What saved us was the Korean War, when they could no longer get brass for lamp parts. And suddenly they forgot all about their grandfather and their great-grandfather and turned to the plastic parts. A six-inch vacuum metallized plastic part, which served the same purpose and looked better, was sold by us for 25 cents compared to $2.50 for the brass part which it replaced. This ultimately led to vacuum metallizing metal parts for lamps just as well because customers liked the parts that didn't tarnish and were returning lamps to have the same kind of a finish on the metal parts if they wouldn't tarnish and would not have to be polished. It developed into a huge industry. In 1945, when I was working for Columbia Plastics making umbrella handles, there was a limit to the number of shapes that you could make for an umbrella handle, and they all started to look the same. Under intense pressure from my boss and the customers, I developed a process for internally carving plastic and coloring it, which led to tremendous sales and the whole decorating of acrylic part industry which we have today. As I mentioned before, we started RLR, the vacuum and pressure forming business, and at that time there was nobody who made any machinery for it. So I designed and built a vacuum forming machine which was totally automatic. You clamped the sheet in, pressed two buttons, walked away, and came back whenever the cycle was over, unclamped them, and took the parts out. I also designed and built various types of pressure forming. Danny was extremely and is extremely able in the technology of vacuum and pressure forming, and we were doing practically every kind of pressure and vacuum forming that's done today. A very dear friend, Dr. Herman Kaufman, who was head of plastic research at Allied Chemical and later dean of a technical college at Rutgers, called me to find out the feasibility of molding a part for one of his consulting clients. It turned out to be Decnatel, who were manufacturing thoracic devices. They were doing it by hand in a laborious, inaccurate, and exceedingly expensive way. I ended up redesigning the whole unit, making it foolproof in assembly because if the unit did not work correctly, a patient could lose his life. And had an extraordinarily wonderful customer. We molded the parts for them and were less expensive than the Japanese company who was doing the same. They assembled the parts themselves, again very inefficiently, and we took over that assembly job. They were the Cadillac of this part of the medical equipment scene, and they were bought out by Pfizer, and eventually private investors bought it back from Pfizer. When President Reagan was shot under the armpit, the bullet penetrated his chest, and nobody realized it until the head thoracic surgeon saw him at the hospital and immediately used one of the units we made to save, to drain the blood from his chest, which we were told saved his life, and had it not been done within 5 minutes, we would have had another assassination on the terrible list of American tragedies. About 35 years ago, Dr. Kaufman and I were having lunch together, and we discussed the total lack of training facilities for people running plastic plants, mold makers, designers, and so on. And we jointly came up with the idea of running all-day seminars. He thought he could give one on plastic materials, and I thought I could give one on injection molding. We went to SPE, Society of Plastic Engineers, and they embraced the idea vigorously. And on a Tuesday, Herman gave the first full-day lecture, which was on materials, and on Wednesday, I gave the first lecture on injection molding. This was the beginning of the seminar programs which have been copied throughout the world in the plastic industry. It did two things for me. Number one, it taught me how colossally ignorant I was about the whole injection molding process. And number two, it gave me a very, very good idea of the caliber of people and the knowledge they had who were running the plastic industry at that time in the country. In the course of one of my lectures, I made the offhand statement, it would be a great idea if somebody wrote a book on injection molding. About 2 months later, a little box, a squib, appeared in the SPE journal, which was their technical publication at the time, saying that Rubin is writing a book on injection molding. And I sent them one of my famous letters telling them that they were full of you-know-what. And the next thing I know is another little squib confirming the fact that Rubin is writing a book on injection molding. It turned out to be a blessing in disguise, because I found that it was absolutely essential to know something before you can write about it. And it forced me to stop and think and really evaluate what the process was all about, to do a lot of experimental work in my plant, to measure, find out, change, to give me a clue as to where we were going. And the net result was I developed a theory of injection molding, which in effect changed it from a black box type of operation to something which followed the standard laws of physics, with the exceptions that plastic material inherently had. I think my major contribution to the plastic industry is in the area of plastic education, both by the lectures and much more importantly by the book, which became the standard book on injection molding. It was published in 1972, and it's still selling today, an amazing thing for a technical book. What made the book so successful was, first of all, it was written with the object of making money. Secondly, it was written in such a manner that anybody who could have gone to college should be able to understand it. For example, if there was an equation, and there were equations, I explained what the equation meant, so if you were not familiar with calculus, you would not get lost and skip over it. And it also included the experience of somebody who started in the very beginning and built up a very successful molding operation, who understood what was really needed and what information was really required to run a plant. And finally, and very importantly, I had a grasp of what the reader needed to know because of my experience in teaching the SPE injection molding full-day course. Another result therefrom was that the publisher, Wiley, came to me in 1988 and said there was a real need for a plastic handbook. I tried as hard as I could to get out of it, but I couldn't. And I gathered together 13 of the best men in the plastic industry. And we met many times, developed a brand new type of handbook, went to the people who manufactured the material, to the experts in every field, and compiled a 1,700 plus page handbook, which I am told is the granddaddy of them all. This was less the result of my doing than the collective work of some of the greatest brains and hardest workers in our plastic industry. I selected those names by reading each one of the 32,000 plus names of the membership roster of SPE. My work in education led me to become a fellow of the Society of Plastic Engineers, and to my total uncomprehending amazement, be nominated for and elected to the Plastic Hall of Fame. Considering the huge number of people who have made contributions to our industry, being elected to such a distinguished and remarkable group is something I still do not fully understand. I was walking through the halls of an Antec a while back, and one of my good friends came up to me and said, "Congratulations." I said, "What for?" He said, "You're eligible to become a member of the Hall of Fame." I said, "Wow." He said, "However, you're not going to be inducted." And I asked him, "How come this signal honor?" Well, he said, "We have only 9 places. They elect 3 a year, and it's done every 3 years at the NPE in Chicago. We only have 9 places, but we had 10 equally capable people. So we selected one, which was you, to be nominated and elected next time." And I said, "How did you come to this great sensational conclusion and select me?" "Well," he said, "we figured you're most likely to be alive 3 years from now." Happily, that was the case. I have been an activist for plastics for a long, long time, having appeared on TV in one-minute spots replying to attacks on foam plastic cups, to half-hour programs on the local New York television stations. I have written many letters, many articles, all trying to tell how wonderful plastic is. Number 17. I was a very active member in SPE, being president of the New York section in 1957. Also in that year, I was vice chairman in charge of all arrangements for the 1957 Antec held in New York City. On a national level, I was chairman of the Technical Volumes Committee and jumped the total number of books published by the Society from 2 to 12, and more important, established the procedures for the ongoing technical publications of the Society. I was also chairman of the Publications Committee. I was a liaison person between SPE and the American Chemical Society, And I was also chairman of the I.T. Quarnstrom Foundation, which is a foundation established by the I.T. Quarnstrom, who started Detroit Mold Engineering, which we know today as DME, and whose purpose is aiding the development of mold makers and mold designers. I was president of the Plastic Molders Guild. I'm a member of the American Chemical Society and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. I was a consultant to New York City Board of Education on plastics, an adjunct professor at the New York Institute of Technology, a consultant to the UN for developing injection molding plants in mainland China, and a member of the Plastic Pioneers Association. 21. I have been privileged to know many of the plastic pioneers who have founded the industry, who have developed the industry, many of whom have become personal friends. It would be rather difficult to include them in tape of this kind. 22. I would not urge my children or grandchildren to go into the plastic industry. It is not that there's anything wrong with it, but that it is a difficult industry because of the lack of knowledge we really have about plastic material, and because there's a consolidation towards larger and larger and larger companies, which limits the ability of a person to really advance. My recommendation to my children would be in the area of computer science, communication science, of the service sector, to go into the service sector of the economy, which at this moment seems to be most likely to grow more dramatically. 23. I have been most fortunate in that I have been able to see an industry grow from nothing to the second largest user of material and the third largest employer in 50 years in the business lifetime of an individual. The sense of discovery, the newness of the problems every day, the exhilaration of doing things and making things that nobody had done before or even thought of 50 years ago has made it, for me at least, an absolutely fascinating experience which I would not exchange for any other vocation or profession. In a true sense, I was part of the Daniel Boones of American industrial development in the last half century. The injection molding industry was primarily started by GIs coming back from World War II. They had no money, but they had brains, courage, and vision to go into an industry about which nobody knew very much, whose future was uncertain, and they applied themselves and have given this country the basis for its extraordinary industrial growth. Number 24. I have mentioned some of my greatest business successes in the other portions of the tape. I would think that my real business success was the ability to give our customers the best possible information about their plastic needs, to be helpful in helping them solve other problems which drew upon our varied experiences in many different industries. And the realization that a small, little, insignificant company like me can be a supplier to major corporations. It reinforces the idea that was instilled to me when I was a child by my parents, that the greatest of all powers in this world is knowledge. And that if you have knowledge and you're willing to use it and you're willing to work hard, you have a great opportunity. My maternal grandmother, who came here in the 1800s, who could speak and read and write fluently in 7 languages, once told me that the greatness of America is freedom and the ability to make and keep money. Because of this, she said, anyone who is willing to study and learn and work hard has a great chance of being successful. The plastic industry has afforded me the opportunity to do this, for which I will be forever grateful. I have many molded parts and other items that go back to 1940. They presently are in my garage and too numerous to mention, and I would appreciate a spot where I could deposit them, where they would be archived and on occasion exhibited. This concludes the tape. Thank you for listening.